Welcome to Inside Economics. I'm Mark Zandi, the chief economist of Moody's Analytics, and I'm joined by my two trusty co-hosts, Chris Derides and Marissa Di Natale. Hi, guys.
Hey, Mark.
Good morning.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you.
Happy Friday to you.
Yeah, what's going on? Anything interesting?
It's cold in Philadelphia.
I know. I'm looking out the window. I made my way back to Philly. You'll be happy to know.
Did just the
15-hour trek with my wife and two dogs. We made our way up. Got caught in Washington, D.C. traffic. Or otherwise, I would have had record time. But alas, you know, Washington messed me up.
Relate to that. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And I heard, Mercy, you're headed off to Whistler. Is that like a ski vacation or what?
Well, it is a business trip, but it's at the Four Seasons in Whistler. So I'm turning it into a little bit of a personal trip on the front end.
That sounds nice.
Yeah.
Very good. Yeah.
Somebody had to go. So I volunteered, you know, someone had to fall on the sword.
You drew the short straw.
Okay. Right. Yeah.
What do you fly into Vancouver and you drive up to Whistler?
And then it's like a 2-hour drive north to Whistler.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I don't ski though. So this is sort of wasted on me.
Well, I hope they have snow. You can report back next week.
They do apparently. Yeah.
Good. Well, we have a guest. We already kind of teased her, Heidi Scherholz. Heidi, good to see you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited for this conversation.
Well, you say that now. We'll see how this goes. Heidi's the president of the Economic Policy Institute, EPI. Welcome. I knew your predecessor, Larry Michel, quite well. Larry, is he retired or is he still? I see his tweets, actually. He's still.
He's retired, but he's technically retired, but is just, you know, staying in the game, doing as much as he can. He's a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah. I remember I got to know him pretty well in the financial crisis back because he held a lot of meetings and informational there were no webinars back then, but we had different convenings and that kind of thing to try to get a grip on what was going on. But very, very good guy. Mm-hmm. When did you become president of EPI? When did you take over from Larry?
Well, you know what? There was a person in between. So Thea Lee was president for 3.5 years, but then between Larry and me, but then she went into the Biden administration. She runs the international unit at the Department of Labor now.
Got it.
And so I took over at EPI in the summer of 2021. So it's coming up on 3 years, 2.5 years, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I'm a longtime EPIer. I first joined EPI in 2007. So I have a rich history at the organization, but just have been running it for the last couple of years.
And would you characterize yourself as a labor economist? Would that be fair?
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Labor economist by training. Yep.
Yeah. Right. And so you've been at EPI all in for how long? Did you say?
Well, I first came in 2007, and then I took what I always call like the most stressful sabbatical in the world. In 2014, I went to be chief economist at the Department of Labor for 2.5 years, and then came back to EPI.
Very cool.
And then, you know, became the president after that.
Got it. And you want to tell us a little bit about EPI? You know, what the it's a think tank. Is that okay to say you're thinking?
Totally. Yes. Okay. I think I don't feel like anyone quite knows what a think tank is, but it's a reasonable description. We were formed in 1986. So we're a long running think tank. And the core mission is to really bring the interests of low and middle income people into economic policy discussions, like just to make sure that those voices are heard and that we understand just sort of shedding light on what really will create an economy that's both strong and agile and fast growing and fair, where productivity growth is broadly shared. That's sort of our core mission.
And I don't know if you appreciate this, but or maybe I'm saying something I shouldn't be saying, but I kind of think of think tanks kind of along the political spectrum. Do you do that as well? Is that fair to do? You know, like I think of like a Brookings kind of little bit left of center. I think of American Enterprise Institute, AEI, a little right of center. Is that fair? And where would you put yourself relative to those folks?
I think it is fair. I always just think we look at the data. One thing that people will say about EPI is no matter what you think about our last paragraph and the conclusions that we draw from the data that we analyze, no one's taking issue with our analysis, right? Like we do really rigorous work, but then the conclusions will line up with a more progressive view of, you know, what do we need to do to solve whatever problems have been that we've focus underlined on with an analysis.
Got it. And I know Josh Bivens pretty well. He's a really good, and talk about data dependent or oriented. He's very data dependent. Actually, in preparation for our conversation, I was reading a number of your blogs and other pieces, and chock full of data. You're going to be really good at this stats game later in the conversation. You got a lot of stats. How many scholars are there, for if that's the right word, economists, scholars at EPI?
I shouldn't have this off the top of my head. We have roughly 50 people total, and maybe a total of 8 economists.
Got it.
PhD economists. And then there's others who are master's level analysts and those kinds of things who would also say are scholars. I mean, I'm sure you will agree with me that a PhD in economics is neither necessary nor sufficient for doing good, high quality economic analysis. But we do have that stable of PhD economists.
Got it. Well, it's great to have you. And there's a lot of topics to talk about. I want to talk about the immigration. This is no order of importance, but immigration, because I know you've been writing about that a lot. That's been in the news, obviously, recently, given the surge in immigration and is the consequences for lots of different things. Artificial intelligence, AI, and what implications that might have for the labor market, income inequality, unionization. But I want to begin with the Fed, because this is top of mind. The Fed met this week, they had a meeting, reaffirmed the federal funds rate target at 5.5%. And I thought maybe I'd just quickly turn to Chris. And Chris, maybe just give us a sense of just some quick summary of what they did. Your interpretation of the outcome of the meeting. The market certainly liked it. The stock market certainly liked it.
Yeah, they met. They did not change the Fed funds rate. That's the direct actionable piece of things. And then there was the press conference that Chairman Powell held that I think provided that support for the market. My interpretation is kind of looking through the inflation data and that suggesting that 3 cuts are still on the table, or cuts certainly this year are still on the table. There had been some analysts suggesting that that was no longer the case because of the inflation. So I think that was supportive to the market outlook.
Yeah, you feel any better after all this? I mean, about meaning where the, because we've been kind of hand-wringing a bit about the Fed waiting too long here and something breaking, and that's a potential risk to the economic expansion. Do you feel better after all this?
I feel a bit better.
I think,
their outlook is similar to ours, right? With what we have in our forecast. But I am still concerned. This is, you know, the chairman set the door open or left the door open to additional cuts this year, but also suggesting you need to be data dependent. So I worry that the data can be misleading as we've talked about in our previous podcast, the inflation may not be quite as strong once you take out the owner's equivalent rent issue. And therefore we could have still, when the rubber hits the road, will they be willing to make the cut if the official inflation report is still suggesting, you know, something around 3%, for example.
FYI, we've been, it feels like every podcast for the last 4, 5, 6 podcasts, each time we dig deeper into the CPI, the consumer price index, and particularly the owner's equivalent rent, the cost of housing, which is, you know, I'm sure you know, quite problematic in terms of how it's measured and, you know, what kind of impact that's having. Let me turn back to you, Heidi. What's kind of your take on what the Fed's been doing, what it did at the meeting, and how are you feeling about things broadly?
One thing that I think is potentially useful to just mention, I'm sure you've talked about this, but there are just a lot of debates amongst economists about the correct neutral level of interest rates in the economy. But I think no one thinks that current rates are anywhere near neutral. So that's that we just know that to be true. But I think, and you're sort of hinting at this, the rate of inflation really is very close to neutral, a neutral rate right now, if not actually at it. So there's this real imbalance between the two. And I think that if it lasts much longer, could get to be a real problem. It just puts a really stiff drag on growth. One of the things I think about, a sort of the impact that we really all have to worry about right now, is I think the high interest rates are tough on the renewable energy build out. So like that's a big problem. And then to your point, like if they wait too long to raise, right now we have a very, very, very strong economy, but if they wait too long to raise, it could start creating real weakness, even cause a recession. And that then has enormous problem. Like, you know, those are the kinds of things that that's what we want to avoid at really at all costs. And I think about, you know, I talked in the beginning that the mission of EPI is really to bring the interests of low and middle income people into economic policy discussions. And when you talk about a weak economy, like if they wait too long to reduce rates, and that really does cause real weakness in the economy, that churns out inequity. Like weak economies churn out inequity. They churn out racial inequity. They churn out inequity between low and middle income workers and higher income workers. And that's because weak economies, high unemployment, it really hits people across the board. Like all across the wage distribution, wage growth is slower when the unemployment rate is higher, but it's worse the farther down the wage distribution you go. So high unemployment rates are worse for middle income people than for high income people. They're worse for low income people than middle income people. And so you really see weak economies, high unemployment, pulling apart economic outcomes and generating real inequity. So there's this real sort of distributional problem that goes along with waiting too long to lower rates as well.
Yeah, I guess, and I'm very sympathetic to what you said, but I guess if Fed officials probably wouldn't disagree with you, they would argue though that they want to make sure that the unemployment rate is low for as long as possible. You don't want to get the unemployment rate too low. Inflation becomes a real problem. They got to jack up rates and then you get a recession. That's not the kind of world we want. We want steady, low unemployment like we've been getting for the last 2 years.
Yeah. Solid point. I absolutely agree with that. And so the fact that we are seeing inflation just coming down, looking very close to a sort of quote unquote neutral rate right now, is the flip side of that. Like we are seeing this steady decline in inflation. And one thing that I think is potentially important, there was a pretty hot inflation print in January. And then we don't have the February PCE numbers out yet. They should be coming out soon, but we have the February CPI numbers that, you know, it's showing, you know, it came in better. There's a lot of reasons to believe that the January number was kind of a fluke. And I think the pretty steady decline in inflation that we're seeing does, and this big imbalance between the Fed's, you know, just with how high the interest rates are right now, it does make me think that we're kind of moving to, if we are not at the point where the evidence is strong enough that inflation is normalizing, that the Fed needs to kind of start ignoring 1 month pops of hot inflation data, like not change course because you get one hot January. Like I think that's one key thing that I think the broader trends are showing us.
Totally. And I think, you know, I got the sense listening to Powell that he thought that the January and to a lesser degree, the February consumer price inflation numbers, they were, as you said, hot. They came in strong, probably were affected by data issues, seasonal adjustment, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. So I took some solace in that. Hey, Marissa, anything you want to add on the conversation on the Fed before we move on?
He kept reiterating that they're committed to bringing inflation back down to 2%, but he seemed to acknowledge, he was asked a question about shelter inflation, for example, and he acknowledged that they're looking at that data. They know there's a lag in it, that inflation is on the right trajectory. It's been a bumpy few months, so they're being cautious. So he seems to, I don't know, I interpret it as that he is looking through some of that noise, and they are acknowledging some of these quirks in the data. So I don't think that they necessarily need to see inflation at 2% before they do anything. I think he just wants to know that, you know, we need another couple readings on inflation. As long as it's moving lower or it's not moving higher, you know, I think then they're ready to go.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I did notice, which I found interesting, going back to your point, Heidi, about the neutral rate, the so-called equilibrium rate, that rate which where monetary policy is neither supporting nor restraining growth, they raised it just to, I don't know if you noticed, they in the summary of economic projections, so-called SEP, they release that every quarter. These are their forecasts. And in that, they have a long-run forecast and for the federal funds rate target, and they raised it just a tick from 2.5% to 2.6, which is their estimate of the neutral rate, which seems very low to me, you know, in the current context. Feels like in our forecast, we have it at somewhere around 3, and that even feels low. I've talked to a number of economists who think it's even higher than that. But to your earlier point, regardless of where you think that is, it's not 5.5.
Right.
5.5 is a lot higher than, you know,
than 3. Anyone's estimate.
Yeah, anyone's right. Estimate. Yeah. Right. So, okay. Let's move on. And Heidi, I want to just kind of frame it this way. I'm just really curious. So when I read your work and the work that comes out of EPI, you know, I get the sense, and you feel free to push back, you know, because this is just in Zandy's mind, you know, I'm how I think about it. You kind of frame things, all the research you do and the work you do, you kind of frame it in this, I don't know if battle is the right word, but this tension that exists between workers and employers.
Mm-hmm.
Here's some data that I'm just curious how you think about this. So when I think about this tension between workers and employers, I go to national income and I look at where the national income is going. National income is the economic pie. You know, GDP is the value of the things that we produce that generates income, wages, and profits and other sources of income. And we divide that pie up and labor's share of that. And you can see the amount that goes towards compensation, which is wages, salaries, and benefits is, and you can look at the data back to 1947, right after World War II. The average share is, I was going to use this for my stat game, but I just can't wait to say it. So I'm going to use it. 63.8%. That is the average through time back to 1947. The last data point we have is for the fourth quarter of 2023, and the share is 63.8%. It goes up, it goes down. You know, it has obviously been higher. Back in the 80s, early 90s, it was close to two-thirds, maybe even a little higher than that at points in time, because it is cyclical. It goes up and down based on what's going on in the business cycle, to your point about unemployment. But, you know, it's kind of roughly where it's always been. So is that what do you think of that data? What do you think about what I just said? Do I have this right? I mean, if you look at that, take it at face value, you'd say, you know, it's a draw between this battle or this tension that exists between workers and their employers. No?
So one thing that the labor share sidesteps entirely is inequality within income. Like that's, I think, if you look at rising inequality over the last 4.5 decades, the lion's share of it has not come from decreasing labor share. Although if you look like since 2000, you do see decreasing labor share over that period. But the lion's share of it has been like very strong rising inequality within wages, for example, within income. So that's really the source of it. That's where it's coming from. And so that is masked entirely when you look just at the overall labor share. Those are the things where you see, you know, that if you just look at inequality within earnings, that the top 1% just skyrocketing, the top 5% skyrocketing, but a little bit less, the top 10%, you know, like just that kind of fractal kind of inequality. Though one interesting thing is that's been true basically from, you know, 1970. I think of the sort of the real spurt of this rise in inequality starting with the, you know, the early 80s. If you look from 79 to 2019, you see this rise in inequality within income. That's not been true over the last 4 years. If you look from 2019 to 2023, the pattern is the opposite of what we had been seeing over that period, where you saw the strongest real wage growth in the bottom. Like it's exactly the opposite graph. You see the strongest real wage growth at the very bottom, the next strongest real wage growth at the lower middle, and on and on and on, and the lowest real wage growth at the very top. So we have seen a little bit of a reversal in the last, you know, over the pandemic period, and we could talk about, you know, there's lots of reasons for that. But it in no way has undone the massive amounts of rising inequality that happened in the 40 years prior to that. But that's where the meat of the rising inequality is.
Okay, I got it. So it's not really worker versus employer. It's that, you know, if you look at the income of workers, of individuals, it's become more skewed over time, that the folks in the top part of the distribution are taking a higher share of that income, workers are getting their share of the national income. That goes up and down all around, but it hasn't really changed much. But the distribution of where that share is going has become more skewed. That's what you're focused on.
That is absolutely right. And when you think of, I do think that this question of power your point about tension, I think, you know, economists might not have used the word, well, economists definitely use the word power. But mm-hmm. that's been the focus of, you know, who has leverage and is the focus of a huge amount of economic research and theory. But it is, in this case, instead of the sort of fruits of productivity growth going to capital, is the shift has been less to capital and more to like executive pay and pay of and other highly paid professionals. Like that's where we're seeing the big increases.
Okay, got it. I was going to say one other thing. Oh, when I look at trying to quickly measure income inequality, I immediately go to the Gini coefficient. And the, you know, that's the way of measuring what percent of the income is going to low income groups up to high income groups. Just for context, if the Gini coefficient is zero, then that's a perfect equality. And if it's one, it's perfect inequality. And right now, and the census publishes this every year with a bit of a lag. Right now it's sitting 0.49, something like that, you know, kind of halfway in between. That is well up from, say, 1980. So from 1980 through 1990, 1995, it rose very sharply, 0.40 in 1980. I'm speaking from memory, so I don't have it exactly right, but this is roughly right. 0.40 in 1980 to, say, 0.45, 0.46 by the early 1990s. It's kind of meandered up a little bit through the financial crisis. And since the financial crisis, more or less, it has not changed. And as you said, most recently, it feels like it's come in a little bit, although mm-hmm. I'm not sure whether that's just cyclical because the economy is strong or whether there's something more fundamental going. But the broader point is most of the, by that measure, and the question is going to be, is that a good measure? But by that measure, most of the skewing of the income and wealth distribution occurred in the 80s, kind of the first part of the 1990s. Since then, it's been pretty modest. In the last decade, not so much. Is that fair characterization?
So this is a really interesting point. I almost never look at the Gini coefficient, okay. But not that it's bad. I just feel like I don't feel like people have a benchmark in their head for what it quote unquote should be. Mm. And it doesn't give you information about how, as you see changes in inequality, it doesn't tell you the nature of that. Like, so I like to look at like the 50-10 ratio, which would just be like the ratio of the median, the person at the middle, their wages to the 10th percentile wages. So you get a sense of what's going on with inequality at the bottom, and then look at the 90-50 to get a sense of what's going on with inequality at the top. I like to look at those because I just feel like they provide more texture. But I think that
So is the data, the way I characterize it, consistent with kind of the way you think about it, using it, these other measures of income inequality, that, you know, it's really the skewing really was most pronounced in the 80s, early 90s. Since then, somewhat, but not nearly to the same degree. And in the last decade or so, not so much. Is that fair? Or is that in your mind's eye kind of how you see things?
That is, oh my gosh. Now, this is the minute I get off of this podcast, I'm going to run to look at the sort of decade by decade trend, because I don't have them in my head. So one thing we know is there has been a reversal since 2000, you know, since the business cycle that started in 2019. And your point is, we're still in that. We have to see how that is going to play out. Yeah. But if you look before that, we still saw like the business cycle from 2007 to 2019 was just, it had the weakest, one of the weakest recoveries, if not the weakest, slowest recovery on record. That was a policy choice. It didn't have to be that way. We did not do the fiscal policy that would have created a strong recovery in that following the Great Recession, like we have following the COVID recession. But I know that what that does, that kind of weak recovery does, is really increase inequality. So I have to look back, but I think we have seen pretty steady rising inequality in the, mm-hmm. the measures that I focus on the most over that period, but I'm definitely gonna look. And we did see, like, in the late 90s, we saw improvements with the very strong labor market of the late 90s. So it definitely isn't, it isn't some kind of monotonically rising inequality over that period.
Well, okay,
but let's look.
Let's stipulate that the income, and we haven't talked about wealth, but certainly wealth is much more skewed today than it was 40 to 50 years ago. And it much of that happened early on in the period, but it's still happening to some degree, but less so. So, you know, debate as to what degree. But before we move on, because what I want to do is kind of dig into the reasons for this and what that means about things as we look forward. And we're going to talk about, you know, immigration, you know, AI, technology more broadly, unionization, forces, and I've got a couple of other theories I'd like to bounce off you if we've got time too, in terms of income and wealth inequality that I think might be interesting. But before we do that, let me turn back to Marissa and Chris. You've been hearing this discussion around how to measure income inequality and the way things have been framed so far. What do you think? Anything to add there, Marissa? Anything to add, or to anything you want to say?
No, I mean, I'm interested in when you were talking about the late 1990s, early 2000s, right? I mean, that was arguably the best run in the labor market we've had in recent history, and was in part spurred by the internet, right? So now we're facing down the possibility of AI, which I know we're going to talk about. So I am very curious to hear your thoughts on what that might mean for all of these things we're talking about.
Chris, anything?
I guess a question I'll ask, I think this is probably on the minds of some of the listeners right now, is when you're running down the income inequality statistics, is that gross income or net of transfers? That's always a subject of debate. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Are you just talking about income, earned wage income, and what that distribution looks like? Or are you accounting for taxes as well as transfer payments?
Yeah, that's... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I tend to there's so much to focus on, just making a choice of, I tend to focus on pre-tax and transfer income just because I'm interested in what the market is delivering for working people as a sort of a core interest. But the trends aren't massively different. If you look at, we have a very well targeted transfer system in the sense that it helps the people that it gets to, but it's very small. And so it doesn't have a huge impact on the overall trends, but it's not nothing. And that's a really good question. It's a really good point. I mean,
okay. Well, like most everything, it boils down to how you measure it.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
But in this case, I'm pretty sure no matter how you measure it, income and wealth has become more unequal over the last 40, 50 years. I don't know that there's
certainly wealth. Yeah.
Yeah. Certainly. And certainly
a question of degree, right?
A question of degree. And also more recently, to what degree has the skewing become less pronounced or has not increased to the same degree, that kind of thing. Okay. Why don't we do this before we dive into immigration, AI, unionization? Let's play the game, because this is pretty dense already. The conversation was pretty dense. The stats game is we each put forward a stat. The rest of the group tries to figure that out with clues and questions, deductive reasoning. The best stat is one that's not so easy, we get it immediately. One that's not so hard, we never get it. And if it's apropos to the topic at hand, income and wealth inequality and those issues, the better. We always start with Marissa. It's tradition. So we're going to start with Marissa.
We don't know why, but we do.
Yeah. And Marissa's pretty good at this game. I'd say really good at this game. So watch out for her.
Okay.
I really, Heidi, in honor of you, I really wanted to pick a labor market statistic because I also am a labor economist and worked at the Bureau of Labor Statistics before I came to. So
was Heidi your boss, Marissa? Is that possible?
I don't know. No.
Oh, okay.
I was there a long, long time ago, but then I thought if I picked a labor statistic, I wouldn't have any chance of stumping you. So I'm going in a different direction. Okay. My statistic is 17 years and 1 month.
17 years and 1 month. Does it have to do with income and wealth inequality?
No, it doesn't.
Oh, so it's totally unrelated.
It is. Yeah.
Okay. Is it labor market related at all?
No.
No. Okay.
And is it a stat that just came out this week?
Yes.
Why do you say it that way? Either it did or it didn't.
Yes, it did. This calculation
see
was
how
made
she does this?
Yes, she's good at it.
She's really
this.
Good at this. Yeah. The intonation, like she puts doubt in your mind. Like, okay. This week.
Is it a record high of something?
It is no, it's not. Let me give you, I thought you guys were going to get this right away.
Is it something to do with housing and being able to afford a home?
No.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
It is related to monetary policy. So back to our original discussion.
Oh, monetary policy. 17, what did you say? 17 years and what?
And one month.
Is it something that happened 17 years ago, 17 years and 1 month ago?
Yes.
Oh,
the last, okay. Yeah. Last time this happened was 17 years and 1 month ago.
Okay. I'm doing the.
Yeah. The arithmetic. That would be
2007.
And the last time the Fed kept the funds rate at its terminal rate. No, Okay. Because 2007, that's right before the financial crisis, right? Well, did we get, is it 2007? Yeah, it has to be. Right. Yeah.
Yes.
What happened? 2007 was right before the crisis. The funds rate was sitting at, was it sitting at 5.5%? Yeah. No. Come on, Chris, you gotta chime in, man.
So wait, this is March 2007. Is that the, is March 2007 the benchmark?
February 2007.
February. Okay. 1 month.
Yeah. It does,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. This is great. So oh, what right. happened February of 2007?
February 2007.
Okay.
February 2007. Something the Fed did in February of 2007. Is that right, Marissa?
No. Not the Fed.
Oh, not the Fed.
Not the Fed.
I thought she said the
something
Fed.
Something Congress did in February.
I didn't say the Fed. I said it has something to do with monetary policy.
Oh, right.
Oh.
Right.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, wow.
I don't know. Heidi, I give. What do you...
I don't know. I want to, like, call a friend. I don't know.
Yeah, right. It's going to be something we should have said. Oh, we should have known that. But
yeah.
Go ahead, Marissa. What is it?
This was the last time the Bank of Japan raised interest rates. So the Bank of Japan just ended its 17-year policy of negative interest rates this week.
Yeah, that's a big deal. That's a good one, but totally unrelated to anything, Marissa. I'm just saying.
We had some discussion about
it. You had that Fed comment in there.
See how she
put
does
us off
that.
The path.
Yeah,
we talked about interest rates and monetary policy. It's not unrelated.
No, that's a good one, though. That's actually a very good one. So quickly explain what happened. What did BOJ do?
The Bank of Japan raised its short-term, basically overnight deposit rate earlier this week to just above zero, a range that's just above zero. The Bank of Japan had a policy of negative interest rates on deposits for the past 17 years. So they've been trying to stimulate the economy by actually making depositors pay banks to keep money in accounts and banks. And they also, with this announcement, ended a bunch of other things, control over the bond. They still have control over the Japanese bond market, but they ended investment in things like REITs and exchange traded funds and a bunch of other things to try to stimulate the Japanese economy. I mean, it's interesting because Japan, the reason that they did this is because, of course, Japan had been mired in extremely slow growth, slow productivity growth, deflation for years, but now the Japanese economy is actually inflating even a little bit above the BOJ's target. It's inflating at over 2% year over year. And the sort of catalyst for this is that there was a very large negotiation of Japan's largest labor union that affects millions and millions of workers. They got the largest wage increase of over 5% that they've... Oh, okay, I can bring this back to the topic at hand, to Heidi.
Okay, good.
They got the largest wage increase that they've gotten since 1991.
Right.
And so the bank believes this will be inflationary for the economy. The economy is weak, though, you know, so this is a bit of a controversial move because it's not as if the Japanese economy is growing quickly or even, you know, inflating that much. Right. So they did this, but they also cautioned that we're not so keen to keep raising policy rates. We're going to be really cautious and we're going to go really slow with this because we recognize the economy sort of teetering on the brink of recession. And like the Fed and many other central banks around the world, they're kind of treading this line between taming inflation but not wanting to stall the economy's growth.
Yeah, that's a really good one. I mean, it's the only major central bank, maybe the only central bank that's raising interest rates. Everyone else is getting ready to cut. But that's a great one. Heidi, you want to go next?
Well, I was going to do something that is a topic that we'll discuss after this, but should I still go for it? Should I give you the rough topic?
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
I'm just debating between two different ones, but I will just go with, because it's round number 75%, and it has to do with unions. I'll just
75%. It has to do with unions.
Think of, I'll let you ask questions before I can give hints.
Okay. That's a percent of some group that is unionized?
No.
No.
That would be really
no. High. Yeah. Right.
That would be high, right? Because
is it a percent of a group that wants to be unionized?
No.
Oh, but is that closer? That's
it like is getting closer. Closer as far as like people's
right.
Think thoughts about something.
Okay. Right, right.
It's people's thoughts about something, not actual.
Oh,
right. People who approve, percent of the population that approve of unions.
Okay, that is very, very close. Okay, so okay. That is very, very close.
But you could say, Mark, you got it right. You could say that. No.
That is very, very close. It is, and that's the other one I was going to do. But it is, stick with that thinking, but yeah. Then think of major union actions that got a lot of coverage.
Oh, you mean the UAW?
The auto strike?
Oh, or the writer strike.
First one.
Oh, the UAW strike.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, so 75% of people felt positively about what the UAW did when they struck the automakers.
That's right. Right.
Oh,
the
cool.
Share of people, the share of Americans who like that sided with the UAW in their labor dispute with the yeah. U.S. auto companies.
Right. Is that like a
Gallup?
A Gallup? Yep. Gallup poll?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, that's good. What's your broader point? Is it that people are? Is it my? Again, this is just in my mind's eye. People have historically kind of looked at in recent history, not all time history, but in recent history have looked with a jaundiced eye on unions, but that may be changing.
That is exactly my point, that we are in this period of just incredibly broad support for unions. People reporting that they think reporting that unions are good for the economy, that unions should be stronger, that, you know, like we're near record highs for union approval, the broad union approval that I didn't go with, but is very close to these numbers. It's just a very, very different environment than where we, those numbers weren't anything like that in the more recent past. So it's a big shift.
Let's just dwell on that for a second. We'll come back. But why do you think this perception is changing? What's going on?
Yeah, I feel like there'll be lots of dissertations written about that. I think one of the things that is like the incredibly large support for the striking UAW workers. Nothing is polling in the U.S. at 75% now. No. Like nothing. Thing. It is just remarkable that there is this sort of unity around unions. I think it working people, even though we have a very strong economy, growing real wages, unemployment at less than 4% for more than 2 years now, all of those things are remarkable, but we still have a huge share of people that are, living paycheck to paycheck, they're really struggling. And I think what we have seen in the recession in particular, and post-COVID in particular, is that unions were kind of standing up and demanding things, and people have seen unions get wins for their workers. And I think it's really struck a chord. I think that it's a good question. I think the very tight labor markets were one of the things that sort of spurred that process. And then it has been something of momentum building upon itself, where there have been some important wins and people have seen that there is, I feel like there's been some of the relearning of the lessons of, joining together with your coworkers actually gives you power to secure some demands those lessons had been kind of unlearned in the prior 40 years. And what? Sorry, I'll just say one more thing.
Sure.
We do have such low unionization rates in this country after four decades of like relentless attacks on unions, that there's a very small share of people in our economy that actually grew up in a union household or have any like direct experience with unionization. And I think that's one of the things that facilitated those lessons of the power in joining together with your coworkers, that facilitated those lessons being lost, that the tight labor market leading to worker actions and some wins and generating momentum has sort of shifted in the post-pandemic, not that we're post-pandemic, but in the since the COVID era began.
Interesting. I wonder, just throwing it out there, that the high inflation may also be playing a role, because people view the inflation as a ripoff. And to some degree, you know, if you look at profit margins of companies, they've gapped out during the pandemic, meaning they've raised their prices much more significantly than the cost of labor and other input. And the margins are no longer rising. They're starting to come in, as you would expect, as competition kicks in lots of different industries. But people are paying higher prices for everything. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, this, and they haven't seen this before, you know, in many of them in their lifetime. And they view this as, it's just unfair. It's just a ripoff. And maybe a union is a way to get, you know, the higher wages necessary to, you know, fight back and maintain purchasing power. Just a thought. Yeah.
No, I am sure that has a part of it. And it's really hard to parse out, like, what are different causes of it. But that has to be playing a role. That just has to be playing a role.
Well, here, while we're on the topic, before we move on to Chris and his stat, while we're on unionization, we might as well play this out. The one, I've done a lot of, you know, fair amount of modeling of trying to understand what has driven the skewing of income and wealth distribution. And, you know, there's a lot of measurement issues that Chris brought up and lots of other things that go on. But the one thing that in every model I've built, I mean, every single one of them is share of the labor force that's unionized. That is like critical to explaining, you know, what's going on. And it's been steadily declining. I think it kind of the symbolic event was when Ronald Reagan broke the air traffic union.
Yep.
I think that was 1979 or 1980, wasn't it? Somewhere in there. But it might have been in 79 or something, because wasn't Carter? No, was it?
It would have had to have been in 80, right? Because he came in.
Was it? Oh, it was 80. Yeah, it was 1980.
80. This is
1980.
Noble.
Sorry. Yeah, 1980. And since then, that's when the skewing of income and wealth inequality became, you know, much more pronounced. So when unions really started to fall off as a share of the labor force. I'm sure that conforms with your thinking that the unionization is one of the key critical reasons why income and wealth inequality has become more skewed is the decline in the labor force that's unionized.
Yep, it's absolutely. I mean, unions, people who are in unions get higher wages, better benefits than similar workers who aren't in unions. Like if you take into account age, experience, education, occupation, blah, blah, all the things. There is a union premium. You get paid more if you're in a union. But then at least as big of an effect is the union spillover effect, that when unions are strong, they actually help set standards more broadly in the economy. And as union density goes down, that spillover effect just weakens because there's less, you know, your employer, there's sort of less, if that spillover effect is because non-union employers are like, well, I better pay decent wages or my company might unionize and I don't really want that to happen. If the union density is really low, that threat becomes a lot less real. But we did, like with the UAW strikes, we saw that spillover effect just playing out in real time. The wages of Hyundai, Honda, oh my gosh, there's Toyota, and now there's more, but got raises. The workers at those unions got raises. They did not strike. They are not even unionized, but they got raises like 5 minutes after the successful strikes at GM, Ford, and Stellantis. And that's just like, that's the union spillover effect just right there. So that both of those dynamics contribute together to the decline of unionization having played a real role in the increase in inequality. And then I will also just say the other big thing that when we when we look at you know, what has driven the rise in inequality, the two big, there's others, but two big ones are the decline of unionization and too high unemployment. Like too high unemployment for much of that period just causes inequality. And can I just say one more thing on this? Because we haven't talked about race much in this discussion, but one thing that I think is not well understood is, like, I think most people think, oh, well, the black-white wage gap, it may not be improving as quickly as we'd like it to, but it must be better now than it was 45 years ago, right? It is not. The black-white wage gap is worse now than it was in 1979. And one of the, it has improved over this, you know, the 2019 to 2023 period when things have gotten better, but it is still worse than it was in 1979. And I think the decline of unionizations is a core part of that, because the union premium is higher for Black workers than it is for white workers. And there's lots of reasons for that, but Black workers are more likely to be in unions than white workers. So unions actually are a key force to reduce the Black-white wage gap. And so as unions density has gone down, it's coincided with Black-white wage gap rising.
Interesting. Well, I do want to move on to Chris, but since we're kind of on the topic of reasons for the skewing of the income and wealth inequality, and you kind of sort of mentioned it, was the persistently high unemployment that existed in periods. Here's a theory I want to throw out and get your take on. And this goes back to monetary policy. And that is, you know, from the late 70s, really when Paul Volcker became chair of the Fed, through Alan Greenspan up until Bernanke, inflation was high, and the Fed's goal in life was to get that back down, to get inflation back down, get inflation expectations back down, tethered. And the way the Fed did that was by running a policy that Alan Greenspan dubbed as opportunistic disinflation, which meant run a soft economy, run an economy with, you know, persistently higher unemployment that's higher than the full employment unemployment rate, so that you get wage growth moderating and get inflation back in the bottle. And it, you know, it worked, but one of the casualties of that policy, and I'm not saying I had a better idea how I would do that, but I'm just trying to explain why in the 80s and particularly in the 90s, we saw this very significant skewing, is because we had, you know, this policy of persistently high unemployment, opportunistic disinflation to get inflation back in the bottle. Does that resonate with you, that theory, Heidi?
Yes. Yeah. No, I think that's right. Although when you look, if you look at inflation and the Fed's target, it used to be like pre-79, you saw, you know, sometimes they'd miss it on the high side, sometimes they'd miss it on the low side. So it really looked like a target. And then you move into an era where they're just consistently missing it on the low side, like inflation actually lower than their target. And I think this is kind of what you're like, that's that. In other words, having full employment be the casualty there, and working people really pay the price for that.
Interesting. Okay, Chris, and we'll come back because we got to go through all the different other factors driving all this. But Chris, what's your stat?
Okay, I'm going to go a little off of the topic here. I guess it indirectly relates to inflation, monetary policy, but very indirectly. The stat is 644,000.
The housing stat?
It is. There's a lot of good housing data this week.
Yeah.
She is good at this game.
It's not new home sales, is it? Because that's around that number, but that would be too easy, I think.
No.
Is it a sales number?
Nope.
Is it a start
construction number?
Yeah.
It is a construction number.
Okay. Single family or multifamily? Single family?
Nope.
Multifamily.
Yes.
It can't be, it's not complete, it's not in the pipeline, because that's about 1 million units.
Permits?
No, you almost said it, Mark. It's not in the pipeline.
Completion.
It's not at the start of the pipeline.
Completion.
Oh, somewhere in the pipeline? It's going to completion?
It's at the end of the pipeline.
Oh, it's completion. It's 644. Okay, completion. Okay. Got it. Which is a high number. Okay.
It's a very high number.
Yeah.
It's 20... 1% increase over the month.
Wow.
Right? 19% Whoa. Increase over the year, right? So it's a very high number. It's actually, I looked, it's the highest single month level of multifamily completion since 1986, right? So it's,
wow.
right. It's really high.
Can we tell Chris, high end, low end, affordable, what is it? Can we tell?
I can't tell in this release specifically, mm-hmm. but other data still suggests that most of the construction continues to be at the high end.
Right. Right. So these are luxury apartments in the, you know, big towers going up in DC or Chicago or LA.
Yeah, or even in suburban areas. They may be more geared towards the higher end of that market than the lower end, just because we've talked about zoning and other things to death.
Right. But
that still is the skew.
Go ahead, Chris. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was gonna say in terms of it's still not great in terms of affordability. You're not targeting the group that needs the housing the most, but still there is a cascading effect, right? If you're providing more housing at that higher end, presumably you're going to have folks moving out of other properties into those units, bringing up, if the cascade works, some additional housing throughout the spectrum. So another reason perhaps to expect that rent growth may not be accelerating anytime soon. We are adding a lot of units to the housing market. So that's certainly a positive when it comes to keeping inflation down, should support that Fed rate cut in June.
Yeah, one of the most fascinating things, and this just shows how weird I am because I think this is fascinating, but the level of housing construction is extraordinarily high. There's only been one other period in history in the kind of tax-juiced 1980s that the amount of homes we're actually putting up has been higher. I mean, we've got this severe shortage of affordable homes. The vacancy rates are very low, but that's in the context of this really pretty impressive amount of supply coming into the market, right? It's just pretty amazing. And that's one reason why the economy's held up as well as it has in the face of higher interest rates, because the one sector that gets crushed when rates go up is single-family, multifamily construction. And that has not happened. Just the opposite. Yeah. They're pretty interesting.
It has been. That also makes me think of like manufacturing construction has also gone through the roof. Yeah. Like the thing that high interest rates usually hit, and is another version of that. The things that high interest rates usually hit just haven't taken the hit. I mean, the manufacturing construction is the result of the industrial policy bills coming out. But it is one of the reasons I think that the high interest rates just haven't hurt the economy as much as they otherwise would have.
Right. Okay. So going back to income and wealth inequality, we've identified a number of some factors at work here that have resulted in the skewing. We focused on unionization. We talked a little bit about the high, I couched the kind of the perennially high unemployment to monetary policy and the effort to get inflation back in the bottle. The other two, and there are probably more, and I'm going to ask, but the other two explanations for the rise in income inequality that you often hear is around technology and the fact that kind of hollows out and takes a lot of jobs from low income folks and, enhances the marketability and the pay and the compensation of folks that have the skills that can take advantage of the technology. And the other is globalization. And that has a number of different facets to it, trade being part of it, but also immigration. Heidi, any other major factor that you would put forward? And then maybe two questions. One, any other factor? And could you just rank order, those factors in terms of driving the increase in income inequality over the past 40, 50 years? If that's a fair question.
Yeah, it is definitely a fair question. The other sort of bucket of things I would add is the weakening of labor standards. So like, the minimum wage hasn't been raised, federal minimum wage hasn't been raised since 2009. The enforcement of labor standards we do have has gone down. So wage theft is a billions of dollar game every year. So that sort of labor standards bucket is also a really key thing. And then maybe we'll just throw it into the labor standards bucket. There's this rising trend of workers just being forced to sign away their rights as a condition of employment with
right.
widespread non-compete agreements right. and forced arbitration agreements, and all of that is like a way to kind of shift power from workers to their employers, or as we talked about, to working people, to very highly paid people within firms. So, okay, but ranking those things, I think the key ones are too high unemployment for much of this period and mm-hmm. declining unionization. Mm-hmm. Those, and then I think the inequality being caused by technology is essentially zero. I actually talk about why, but I do not think that that's a big part of this story at all. And I could talk about why. Globalization is a core part of it. The way globalization itself isn't a problem. The way we have done globalization yeah. has increased inequality in the U.S. And then this weakening of labor standards is also, and their enforcement is also, I think, a core part of it.
So just to get it summarized, top of the list would be unionization. Second would be kind of this period of high unemployment to get inflation back.
Yeah, those might be reversed. Like maybe might it's be reversed. Too high okay. unemployment, but they're okay. close. Those are, yeah. I would, yeah, I think our data actually show you too high unemployment is the number one. And
number,
then,
okay.
And
okay.
then unemployment, and then sorry, declining unionization is the other real biggie in the game.
Okay. And then globalization kind of broadly defined, mostly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then followed by, labor standards and that kind of melange of stuff.
Things. Yeah.
Yeah. And then at the very bottom, not even on the list, you said, is technology.
Not really?
Okay. Explain that one to me.
Okay. Okay. And I also think immigration just isn't really a player in inequality.
And immigration is not either. So when you say globalization, you mean trade. And
oh, yes. That's a solid point. I do. I don't think immigration is a big contributor at all. It's not zero, but it's not a big contributor. One reason for that is, you know, there's a lot of immigrants that come in on both sides, like very high wage, very low wage. So they may mechanically raise inequality because they come in very skewed. But I don't think it's generating inequality within the like native born population or US born population. Okay. But moving on to technology. So this like idea of skill bias, technological change has really, you know, captured the imagination of economists for a very long time as a key cause of rising inequality. But I don't think it, when you really dig in, it doesn't play out. You don't see it in the data. And one, I'm going to just try to describe a scatter plot here, but it is a simple one. Like the idea for how this would work is that you have technological change that creates high demand for some occupations and then low demand for other occupations. And so that will increase the wages of occupations that where demand grew as a result of technological change and shrink the wages where demand dropped as a result of technological change. So you should see in a scatter plot, if this is a key driver of inequality, you should see that strong relationship where occupations that saw, you know, a big growth would also see higher wage growth. That would be like an absolute like base level, does this theory pass the smell test kind of test? And that scatter plot looks like a cloud. You do not see a relationship between the like size of growth by occupation and wage growth within that occupation. It's just a cloud. And so it just doesn't really hold the smell. What you see is that wages have, inequality has really, a ton of it has happened within occupations. So it's just, doesn't really hold up to the data.
Is that a consensus view, what you just expressed? Or is that,
I think
it a Heidi view?
It is a growing view because there's been growing empirical view. Work coming out showing that there's real problems with skill bias that like David Card, you know, Nobel Prize winner will, you know, has said this theory just doesn't really hold up to the data, but it is such an entrenched view amongst economists that except for the people who are really focused in on it, it, it had been conventional wisdom for so long. I think that the conventional wisdom piece of this is still being eaten away at. But I truly believe that for those who are look closely at the data, it just sort of disappears. There. Yeah.
And what's the explanation for that? How do you, why doesn't that work?
I think it is that it's these other forces that are really what's driving inequality. Like when you see the increase in the, you know, the gap between college workers with a college degree and workers without a college degree, people will say, well, that's because of, you know, higher returns to college. I mean, the college wage premium has not been rising for a very long time now, but, you know, in the 80s, 90s, it was rising. It was the exact same time that unions were taking a big hit, right? And those hit, the same things that hit workers with lower, you know, without a college degree. So it wasn't about them, the technology creating the higher returns to college. It was about the institution of unionization declining that undermined the wages of workers without a college degree. It was about globalization undermining the wages of workers without a college degree, not technological change that boosted the wages of workers with a college degree.
Chris, do you have any view on this? Do you want to push back in any way?
I would tend to disagree. I think. Well, I would.
This is what Chris does.
That's fair. Totally.
I would agree with.
He does this all the time, Heidi. Go ahead.
I would agree with the statement that there's a lot of things happening simultaneously, right? Yeah. So all of these factors were occurring all at the same time: globalization, declining unionization, you know, technological changes, taxes. I'm surprised we didn't include tax, but I guess we're focusing just on the gross, but. I think, to my mind, taxes and transfers are at the top of the list. Inequality, to some extent, is a choice. We could redesign our tax system, redesign our transfer system to eliminate or sharply reduce inequality if we wanted to. So,
which is, if you go look in Europe, where the tax code is more redistributive, the inequality is lower, at least by the measures that we look at.
Yeah,
to your point.
Now, certainly,
if
you want to, you know, I'm not saying it's a simple way, but it's a very direct way if you.
It's not a comment on whether it's good or bad. It's just that's right. A fact.
Mechanically, it's possible. Yeah.
And there are trade-offs. As a society, we've decided that the level of inequality presumably is consistent with the trade-offs we're making for growth or other aspects. That's certainly debatable, but I see that as certainly a lever in our control. I do believe, though, that the technological change is certainly part of the equation. I wouldn't say it's a insignificant piece. My own work, one key aspect is that I find that there are long lags between technological innovations and how the labor market adjusts, right? You have to have businesses adopting technologies, figuring out the best way to use them. You need workers to adjust, you know, realize that there is this demand, that they need certain skills. So I think you'll see that cloud perhaps, but once you start to control or pick it apart, you can see certainly some aspects of it. I'm not saying that technology is the only thing, but I wouldn't say it's irrelevant either. I think it certainly has that aspect. I think we could go through anecdotes certainly historically of, you know, going from typing to use of computers. Clearly there was a factor, a shift there in terms of the returns to certain skills that, you know, have to make a difference, but
I am in total agreement that technology changes the way work gets done. Like 100%, it will change the mix of jobs. I just don't see it as being a driving factor of it. It's kind of it has happened, you know, in such variety of ways and all different things. It's just not driving. I believe it's not driving. I believe the data show it's not driving these core trends.
What about AI, Heidi? Well, you feel the same way about AI? Artificial intelligence. There's a lot of hand wringing about that.
There sure is. There's a lot of breathlessness. I just want to say before I say anything about AI that I do not have any expertise on what the impact of AI might be on national security or on democracy or on, you know, like there's a lot of potential.
Stopped us from talking about it. I'm just saying. So.
I don't have, I don't know, like those things do sound, you know, those potential problems in those areas sound a little, you know, I could get myself worked up about those things without having a ton of expertise. But I do have a ton of expertise on the impact of technology on the labor market. And one thing I think we all need to step back and realize is that technology is on net good for workers. Like it, technology-led productivity growth actually is the thing that makes it possible for wages to grow. And even though over the last 40 years, workers haven't gotten their quote unquote fair share of productivity growth because of, with the things we were just talking about, too high unemployment and globalization and decline of unionization, they've gotten some. Like that is, it is the thing that makes it possible for living standards to rise over time. So I am actually, the idea of a AI-led productivity surge, I think it's, you know, I don't think we're going to get the massive increases that some are projecting at all, but I'm looking forward to that. Like, I think that that's, we want to like those, that kind of growth is a really positive thing. And then you just, how it plays out in individual workplaces, I think really is a matter of who holds the power. And you could see like one thing I always say, like, there is no way that policymakers can micromanage how AI plays out in individual workplaces. It's just too varied. It just is going to play out differently. Like there's, and so the thing that will make it play out in a way that is, that makes sure that workers as well as their employers reap some of the benefits of the productivity growth that happens as a result of AI will be the I think a core way to do it is make sure that workers actually have some leverage to be able to negotiate around AI on their own behalf. And we mentioned this earlier, but the screenwriters, it's a perfect example of the Screenwriters Guild actually negotiated a contract last fall that has provisions that protect workers around the use of AI. It allows the use of AI, but it makes sure that AI doesn't undermine workers' credit for the work that they do. So it's like, you know, they negotiated together how to have AI play out in their workplaces. And that's the way to make sure that it, that we don't see the replay of the last 40 years, but instead we see workers actually getting some of their fair share of the, what I hope will be the, you know, AI driven productivity boost. Mm-hmm. I hope we see that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's, cause we're right. Believe it or not, we've been here for more than an hour, but I do want to talk about immigration because that was also kind of feels like a non-conventional perspective that immigration, and of course, we've been getting a lot of immigrants coming into the country.
Yep.
I mean, the CBO came out with a study recently showing or estimating that the 3.3 million immigrants, legal and undocumented, came into the country in 2023 on top of, I think, 2.6 million the year. Typically, it's about a million and it surged. A lot of that's what's happening at the border. And there's a lot of, again, hand-wringing about what that might mean for, you know, workers. The hand-wringing has been less pronounced just because the labor market's been so tight. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, right, it's been more a plus than a minus, at least with regard to what it means for the labor market and monetary policy. But nonetheless, I think the conventional wisdom is that immigration helps to skew income, the distribution of income. But you say no.
Mechanically it can, because, you know, we talked about this, but immigrants themselves enter the country in a very bimodal way. Like there's immigrants come in with very high levels of education and with very low levels of education. And obviously immigration happens all across the education distribution, but you do see this more bimodal entry than you do for the U.S. born population. And so that mechanically raises inequality, but aside from that, it's not a big factor. As far as job growth go, I mean, right now, U.S. born, keep saying native born population because those are words that BLS uses. And I think U.S. born is a better term.
Oh, is that? Oh, okay. That, I should
yeah,
say
that's
US
why
born.
I always have to translate from what I'm reading in the data to then what I actually want to say when
Good
I speak
know.
It out loud. You know, the U.S. born unemployment rates are at near record lows. Like we are just, this labor market is really strong. It's absorbing lots of immigrants and keeping just incredibly low unemployment rates for U.S. born workers at the same time. But the question I think comes down to wages, and there is a lot of work on this. The most recent, like, comprehensive thing is the National Academy of Sciences did a big study in 2017, like really going over all of the evidence on the impact of immigration on wages. And the biggest the impacts aren't big, period. They're just, it's not a big driver, but the biggest impacts are on earlier immigrants. So it is immigrants come in and they are more likely to do the jobs that that the people in them are already are immigrants themselves. And so the biggest negative impacts are on earlier immigrants. And there are some negative impacts on US born workers without a high school degree. And that is a, not that we should think about that, obviously, the economic outcomes of U.S. workers without a high school degree, but it is a very small share of our labor force. It's something like 6% right now. So it's just doesn't, and other than that, there's just not a big impact except on earlier immigrants.
Marissa, Kirsten, you want to push back on any of that? Marissa? No?
Sorry. No, I don't think so. Okay. Yeah, I was reading a paper that Brookings did the other day on this recent surge in immigration. Mm-hmm. And one
Wendy Elberg
really,
at the Hamilton
yeah,
Project.
One yeah. thing I was really interested to see is they looked at different cohorts of immigrants into the country and what their labor force participation is, like 2 years on after arriving. And the most recent cohorts of immigrants have a much higher participation rate than any immigrants that have come in like the past 10 years. So there was sort of this dip, and then the immigrants that are coming in now are much more likely to participate in the labor force. So it is interesting when we talk mm-hmm. about labor force growth, right, Mark? We talk about this a lot when we see the BLS numbers and how is there all this labor supply? There's way more labor supply out there than we would have thought. And this goes to that explanation. And they're also more likely to participate.
Well, I think
which is doing a service to the economy.
Totally. Right.
Now, right? Yeah. I mean,
yes,
this has actually been a benefit.
Yeah, it sure
to your
has.
Point, Heidi, not taking away jobs, but just adding to the supply of labor in a very tight market where employers are scraping in some industries to find people.
Right. Like immigrants obviously add to both the supply side and the demand side mm-hmm. like that. And so, sometimes I think when people say immigrants are taking all our jobs, that there's this forgetting there. Also, come in and buy stuff and create more jobs as a result. So, but right. they add more to the supply side because they're relatively more likely to work than the U.S. born population. And so it really has helped with our supply side issues. Yeah.
The other thing that people forget is that immigrants, they're risk takers by definition, right? You don't pick up and leave one place with your family, go to another place and have no idea where you're going unless you're a risk taker. So you start companies at a higher rate. Yep. You're more entrepreneurial, more innovative. And there's evidence strong statistical evidence that immigration leads to higher rates of productivity. So it's not just about the people, the workers. It's about, and go take a look at, you know, these tech companies that are driving a lot of the productivity gains. You know, they are, many of them have many immigrants and are led by immigrants. You know, the CEOs and the C-suite of these companies are immigrants. So interesting point. So I kind of created a frame for thinking about how income inequality was create, you know, how we got here and why the distribution become more skewed. Okay, very quickly, because I know we're going to lose Marissa in just a few minutes. She's off to her skiing vacation, and
my flight's delayed like 45 minutes.
Oh, there you go. Okay, okay.
I'm probably going to miss my connection, but fine.
Okay.
So we can keep going. Is what you're saying.
Right? Well, might as well.
I'm sure Heidi's going to say, "What about lunch? Don't you guys eat lunch?" What does it mean for the future? What do you think? I mean, because you put it number one, high unemployment. Well, problem solved. I mean, at least for the foreseeable future, no problem. Unionization feels like you know, we've turned the corner there, certainly with regard to the attitudes. I don't know that we're going to see a large increase in the share, but I don't think we're going to see declines here in the near future. You said immigration doesn't really matter. You said technology really doesn't matter. Trade, we're deglobalizing, so that's going to be less of an issue. And then I guess it leaves, you know, labor laws and regulation, but that's not changing fast. So I don't know that changes the dynamics here to a significant degree. But I don't want to mean to put words in your mouth, but I'm just saying if I take the equation we just estimated and put in right-hand side variables, it feels better to me going forward. It feels like, okay.
Yep. It is weird in this world where so much feels difficult. It is an area of, I feel optimistic about future. The one thing on unionization that is tricky is even with all of the momentum, it is going to take labor law reform to really halt and reverse those trends of declining unionization. Like the deck is so unbelievably stacked against unionization. And I can give you just one example as color to around this. It is technically illegal under our labor law to fire somebody for union activity. Like that is a core part of US labor law. And it nevertheless happens all the time because the consequences to employers of firing somebody for union activity are like a slap on the wrist. If that the worst that can happen to them is that they will have to reinstate, if they go through the whole process and are found to have illegally fired a worker for union organizing or union activity, the worst that can happen to them is that they have to reinstate that worker, give them their back wages minus any wages they earned at a different job in the meantime. It is just a nothing burger. And that is symbolic of how labor law is just relentless attacks have absolutely, it just doesn't. I mean, this is the thing where, you know, there's this massive gap between the share of workers who are in a union and the share of workers who report that they want to be in a union. And that gap is policy not actually truly protecting workers' rights to unionize. So there is the momentum is incredibly important. I think it will make a difference, but it's going to take labor law reform, which is going to take a functional Congress to really do. So that is, we all know the sort of obstacles to that in the future. Well, so that's one thing that we know. Okay, we got work to do on that front.
Well, I have to say, if you're leading the charge in terms of making getting Congress moving in the right direction, we're in good shape. So I feel even more optimistic that you're on the case.
Okay.
So that's good. Okay, I think we took our fair share of Heidi's time. Anything else, Marissa, Chris, you want to say? No? Okay. Hey, Heidi. Yeah, really, really fascinating, fascinating conversation, and really appreciate you coming on to Inside Economics. Thank you.
It was really fun. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And dear listener, that means this is the end of the podcast, and we'll talk to you next week. Take care now.